Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohen.
I'm Kevin Mackett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Sweet from the Wallery.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin and the Edition, not the British.
Yeah.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another edition of Not the Footy Show. And thank you to everyone who tuned in to listen to Anthony Farry on our last podcast. That had a lot of downloads, and we really appreciate you tuning in to listen. We've got another great guest lined up for you today. We're catching up with Paralympic footballer, or a member of the Pararoos as they're known, and that is Chris Barty, whose journey we followed over a number of years, and they finally qualified for the World Cup. So congratulations to them. But we'll hear from Chris later in the show. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
John, good to see you again. And no doubt you're having a lot of sleepless nights watching the hockey and doing your podcast, The Reverse Stick.
Yes, the World Cup Daily podcast is going out every day. It's funny how much, you don't realise how much it'll take out of you. It's immensely enjoyable, but it starts to take a toll after a while.
Now, I believe you're starting us off with a phrase that we have heard during that hockey tournament.
Well, we've not only heard it. What really inspired me to bring this up was the pool draws for the upcoming Women's World Cup, where they had four pots, six teams to a pot, and then you get drawn into your little pools. Australia was in pot A with a world ranking of six, and they were the lowest of those six teams in pot A. Okay. Well, the draw occurred, and Australia was drawn with Brazil, Italy, and Jamaica. And immediately the pundits called it the pool of death. Every time an international Australian team goes into a competition, it enters the pool of death. And frankly, I'm over it. Is there a bigger crock in world sport than the pool of death?
Probably not. To me, the pool of death, it's like, yes, you're at a World Cup, every team should be competitive in every pool. There are, we know, some teams that get there and they are likely to get beaten. But at the same time, they're good enough to be there, so anything can happen. And by calling it the pool of death, you're almost saying, we've got an excuse now why we don't qualify for the next round.
Oh, we'll make an excuse now so we've got something to work with afterwards. Just on specifically this case of Australia's pool of death, let's have a look at it. Australia, ranked number six in the world. How many of those teams are ranked above Australia?
Are Brazil ranked above them?
No, they're in pot C.
So they've dropped down that far, yeah. Well, there you go. So they're the number one ranked team, so they should be expected to come top. And I mean, it was interesting, to be fair, Alan Stajic, the coach, said he was very happy with the teams that they were going to come up against.
I don't think this has come from the team themselves. This is all media-driven. It's all punditry-driven. The pool of death. Really, Australia versus Jamaica.
The one thing I wonder, just on top of that, is had they drawn out the team logos, would anybody have actually known who Australia were with their new fantastic logo, the three paper clips lying in a triangle?
It is disgusting.
That logo on the top there is the new Football Federation of Australia logo for our national teams there, John. Isn't it wonderful?
It looks like a bit of a funny ribbon with bits cut off.
It's three paper clips, I think, were the inspiration.
It is ball-shaped, isn't it?
Yeah, vaguely.
But
it could be a volleyball, it could be a handball, could be a netball.
Yeah.
Could be any kind of ball.
It
could be a ball your dog chases.
Well, it could be South Africa too, because it's green and yellow. it doesn't strike me. I wonder how much they paid for that. You've already mentioned that, but
I have. But there was a great comment from a guest we had on this show, David Mitchell, who works in that particular field of brand management and everything. And it was interesting that he said, "Oh no!" in the comments on Not the Footy Show Facebook page, he goes, "The first thing you never do is change your logo."
Yeah, well, especially not to one as uninspiring as that. So if you hear anybody in the future use the term pool of death, you know that they have no idea what they're talking about.
So what is it going to be, the group of hell?
It doesn't have to be anything. It's just four teams that have to play the best or they won't be there. And, you know, sometimes you look at what people call a pool of death and you go, yeah, if you're country X, because you've got no hope of beating any of those teams above you. But it's not actually a pool of death.
But okay, let's go back to the draw, and let's be fair, this happens, we see it in the Olympics in hockey, we see it in most tournaments now, how they seed the top-ranked teams. Do you think they should do that? My view today on the way world sport is, and if you look at the recent FIFA World Cup last year, if you look at the Women's Hockey World Cup in London, and even you could say that the Men's World Cup hockey at the moment, the gap between the lesser teams and the top ones, there is still a gap, let's not deny it. But it's not as big as it was. So my point is, why can't you just chuck everybody in a hat and just pull them out?
I don't have anything necessary against the pot idea.
I have a problem with the seeding. I'm just saying, you qualify for a World Cup finals, why do we have to seed the teams? This is meant to be the top 24, the top 32, the top 16 teams in the world in that event. So why do you need to seed?
I think what they do is that they fear they're going to lose one of the better followed and higher ranked teams to a lesser followed, lower ranked team.
And they worry about the TV because the TV's paid a lot of money.
Exactly.
But let's be honest, if you are a viewer, don't you want to see the underdog go on? Like, I mean, Ireland's women was phenomenal in London. The journey that they were on, the media interest that it created was phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, the broadcaster, say, for the Men's World Cup in India would have been in two minds. They would have been happy that India went through to a quarterfinal because that's guaranteed, you know. But they would have been far happier if they had gone to a crossover first and then got to the quarterfinal because that's another game involving India and that's where the viewers are.
Yeah, I know, but I just think, I don't think we need, my view is, I don't think we need to seed teams. When we're getting to world finals, I think every team should go in and you go, okay, first name out of the hat is in pool A, second name out of the hat is in pool B,
If you end up with the top four teams of the world all in the same pool and it means a top four team's going to be eliminated, so be it.
Absolutely.
You know, well, yes. I got nothing wrong with that.
You know, I mean, if you look at club competitions, and there are cup competitions, teams aren't rarely seeded in those. You get drawn against whoever's name comes out of the hat.
Yeah.
And then if you win it, you prove that you are the best.
As long as the commercial advantages fall the way they do, that'll never happen. There'll always be some mitigating factor that means you've got to keep certain teams in tournaments longer. Look, let's face it, it's all, otherwise you wouldn't be paying the players the wages that they get, would you?
No, exactly.
Hi, I'm Willie Miller and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to Not the Footy Show and time for our guest on this podcast. Now this man, he doesn't know if he's in the pool of death, because they haven't done the draw yet for the CP Football World Cup, and that is the Cerebral Palsy Football World Cup. It's been a fantastic story. The Pararoos, who had their funding cut by the FFA because of the Winning Edge program, have stormed back and qualified for their first ever World Cup. And a big, big congratulations to everybody involved, the volunteers, the players, the coaching staff, over all of those period of time, because it's a fantastic achievement. And one of those players, and a man who went around recruiting players, and we've had him on the show plenty of times before, is Chris Barty. Chris Barty, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley. It's great to be here. Thanks, mate.
Well, it's always good to catch up, and I think the last time we spoke, it was a pretty sad circumstances, because that was around the time that the Pararoos funding had been cut by the FFA, but there was a lot of sort of pressure from the public, and then they had this philanthropic approach, which was basically, I suppose, the nation getting behind the team. How did that all come about, and how did you guys feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, look, certainly at the time, it was obviously devastating when we lost our funding and you know, I literally felt as though we had the rug pulled from underneath us. So at the time, the Australian Sports Commission obviously had their Winning Edge approach. The Pararoos at the time were ranked 10th in the world, and we needed to, I think, be top five in order to secure funding from the federal government. Because we were outside of that that criteria, we essentially lost 100% of our funding, which was devastating. and the team was effectively, or the entire program and the sport in Australia was effectively on the brink of collapse. But as you point out, the crisis creates opportunity, and FFA came up with the approach of partnering with the Australian Sports Foundation, who, to their credit, has been absolutely fantastic, and have helped us garner the support of the Australian public. And we've also secured, as of last year, secured a naming rights sponsor for the front of the jersey, Death Healthcare, who have been instrumental in helping us get to major tournaments, and not only get to the tournaments, but prepare for them. And I think because the guys have really had to become expert self-promoters, you know, we do a lot better job of getting out in the community and, I guess, raising the profile of the Paralympics. So from something that was pretty traumatic and you know, seemingly had us on death's door, you know, the Paralympics now, I think, are in as good a shape as we've ever been.
Well, one of the things that also happened around there was you had a new coach, although he had been part of, obviously, the Pararoos program, being the assistant coach, I think it was for almost 9 years, wasn't it, Kai Lammert?
Yep, that's correct, yeah. And look, Kai's fantastic. I mean, he's a little bit of a mad scientist, because not only in terms of his tactics and that sort of thing, but as someone who wasn't born with a disability, he doesn't have any family members with a disability, he just sort of he became involved, first of all, as an assistant coach. He's really taken this sport to heart, and there is no more passionate advocate, I think, in Australia for the Kangaroos and for disability football than Kai Lammert. So his energy and enthusiasm has been first class. You know, there are a number of times, I think as we get a little bit older, I've just turned 30, so, you know, when you sort of think, oh, maybe it's time to retire, but as soon as you have a conversation with Kai for 10 to 15 minutes, you're enthusiastic again and ready to hit the training track. So that side of things has been first class. But on top of that, he's also, you know, a really switched on football coach, and I think technically and tactically, along with Guy Stagic, who of course is the head coach of Balcata here in Western Australia, and Warren Harkness, who's the goalkeeping coach from South Australia, who's previously been involved with FA football. They've really taken Paris to the next level, and I think that's been reflected in our on-field performance.
Well, that's what we're going to now talk about, is your on-field performance, because obviously the team's just returned from the International Federation of Cerebral Palsy Football Asia-Oceania qualifying for the World Cup campaign. And, I mean, it was just a fantastic tournament for you guys. You have qualified for the World Cup, but just let's maybe look at each game a little bit. I mean, to start the campaign with an 11-0 victory over the Korean Republic must have been the perfect start for everybody, but I would have thought also you could have got carried away.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it was the perfect tonic, I think, really, to settle the nerves. I think particularly for our starting seven, because that was a starting seven that was a new combination for us. We hadn't necessarily played with those seven players together an awful lot, apart from the pre-departure camp. And we had young Daniel Campbell starting in the centre midfield. And Daniel's only 15 or 16, but has had a sense of composure much beyond his years. I think that game against Korea was absolutely vital for helping us to gel together. I think Ben Roach, who's our talisman up front, scored 5 goals, which always helps, but you're quite right in the sense that from there, once we sort of enjoyed the initial celebrations, we immediately switched on to the next match.
Well, there were two players as well, I believe, got their first goals for the Pararoos in that game as well, Taj Lynch, and a man who actually graced the athletics track in, was it Beijing and London, WA's very own Brad Scott.
Yeah, that's right. I had the pleasure of rooming with Brad over there, and we've been friends for a little while now. I haven't claimed my recruit's fee just yet, but I had a little part to play in Brad coming across the Pararoos, and look, his experience and again, sense of professionalism and the way that he's prepared, has just added an extra element to the Kangaroos. As an athlete, he's still very much, first class. We had to work with him a little bit on his touch and on his game sense, but certainly, his ability as a number nine is, I think, really exciting and showed in that match against Korea.
Well, your next game was against Thailand, and you knew that if you got a victory in that game, you were pretty much, getting closer to that elusive World Cup spot. I believe they were a very hard team to break down, but you did come out in the end 3-0 up.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, and Thailand's a team that we have never played before. We didn't get a lot of, I don't think we had any video footage of them, prior to the match. One of the really exciting things, though, that the Paras did have this time around, which we haven't had previously, was some coaching staff to assist with opposition analysis. They're actually dedicated to reviewing the strengths and weaknesses of opposition players, and then presenting that prior to each game. So we really, even though we hadn't played them before and hadn't seen them in the flesh, we had a really good understanding of what they could and couldn't do. So that was absolutely fantastic. Tim Palmer, who headed up the analysis and the opposition analysis, came to Kish on his own expense. That was how much he wanted to see the Paris succeed. And it really paid dividends against Thailand because, as you said, obviously new to CB football, the Paralympic football, but very disciplined defensively, played with a lot of heart and tenacity and did get a little fiery in stages, but we managed to keep our composure and put 3 goals on the board.
But he also made a second clean sheet, which must have been pleasing for you.
Clean sheets. I haven't had too many for the Paras over the years, so it's probably more a reflection on myself. But that was really nice. I think we had a really disciplined defensive unit, so always helpful to have David Barber, who's the long-serving captain of the Paras, playing centre back, and then Ben Atkins, who is one of the vice captains of the team, playing at the other centre back position. So between the three of us, we've played a lot of football together. Makes my job, pretty straightforward. Just to have that defensive unit work together so well, I think, again, was another contributing factor to our success.
Well, your next game was against Jordan, and you knew if you won that, you were going to progress through to the final against Iran. And, again, it was Ben Roche with 4 goals, taking his tally to 10, as you came out on top 7-1. So that was, a really big victory.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I call Ben Roche the king of the club sandwich, because the number of times he scored 4 goals in international games is... He's just bizarre. He seems to have a knack for scoring 4 goals. So he did again for us there. There's not too many teams internationally that can contain Ben, particularly when they get to the space on his left foot. Certainly in training, he's the player that if I'm saving a few from Roche, then I know I'm in relatively good form from a shot something perspective. So. And also again his leadership as well, being one of the team vice captains and long time captain of the Victorian program, with instrumental in our a good result.
Now, obviously, you were then through to the final and you were going to meet Iran, but Iran were going to be, and it's not putting the other teams down in the tournament, but they were the real benchmark. I mean, let's not forget they got silver at the last Paralympic Games. They pretty much have a full-time program, I believe. I don't know, you may be able to correct me, but they were going to be a really tough test for you in that final.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Iran, as you point out, were silver medalists at the Rio Paralympic Games. They have a full-time professional program. From what I understand, national service in Iran is compulsory, and the athletes, the people with a disability are given the option of performing their national service by Their build up play is amazing. So where in the other games we were quite active with a full field press against Iran, it was a different style that we had to adapt to pretty quickly in terms of really being rigid in terms of defending our final third. So it was a different challenge for us, but I think a really good litmus test to see where we were at. I felt that our first maybe 5-10 minutes weren't as strong as we had been in other games, but I felt that once we settled into the game defensively, we were actually pretty reasonable and denied them a number of chances, and then also created our other our own scoring opportunities at the other end. So while the score was not something that we particularly enjoyed, I thought that actually in terms of the passages of play, we performed better than we have done previously against a top two nation in the world.
Now, obviously, it meant you'd qualified for the World Cup, which is great news. You're going to Spain in July next year. But there was one more award, and I've got to mention it. I know you won't want me to, but you were voted goalkeeper of the tournament, which, as you say, you've been involved with the team for a long time now. It must have been nice to have finally got over the hill and also your efforts to be recognised.
Yeah, look, really pleasing to win that award, and I think, it's funny, I think sometimes the weeks where you don't have as much to do from a shot-knocking perspective, are the weeks where you tend to get recognised for those types of awards, but I feel it was, as I said before, it was just a reflection on how disciplined our defensive unit was, and the time particularly that Ben, David and myself have spent working together over the years. But I also felt as well that, and I said this on social media earlier in the week, that our goalkeeping unit as a whole is stronger than I've ever seen it. I had to work extremely hard to earn the starting place for this tour. Chris Pine, who's the most capped power of all time, recently got reclassified, which is tremendous news for him and the team, and it's allowed him the opportunity to take up goalkeeping, and Chris has really taken to it like a duck to water, and provided a really, really stiff challenge and a great training partner. But I think in better news as well for the goalkeeping unit, the Kangaroos, Cosimo Cirillo, who's only 16 or 17 years of age, had a terrific national championship for Victoria. He almost won the national championship on his own back, and he's carried that forward in terms of his performances in training with the team. And really, it's not a matter of when he gets, if he gets a starting position, it's just a matter of when if he continues to apply himself the way he has.
Now, I mentioned the World Cup is in Spain next year, in the middle of the year. How are you guys going to be preparing for that? Because I noticed that your coach, Kyle Lammert, was saying that the key thing is he needs you guys together a lot more than he's had you together before if you're going to be competitive when you get to Spain.
Yeah, well, I think, as a point of comparison, the United States, the US Paralympic soccer team, who have really surged up the world rankings in recent years, spend approximately 35 weeks of the year together. Whereas the Paralympics will have about 2 or 3 training camps a year. We do a tremendous job of staying together as much as we can through the magic of the internet and through having a really great support staff. But the critical thing, as Kai said, is just that time in person. Hone our skills and hone our team play. I'm really confident the coaching staff have already mapped out where they'd like us to get to in terms of our style of play. But it is hard to get there if you're not able to put the hours on the pitch. So that's something that's a continued challenge for us to make sure that we get that sorted. And one of the ways that we can do that, obviously, is by securing some more fundraising. But in order for us to secure fundraising, I'd like to think that winning cures most things. So the more games that we can win and the more competitive that we can be at these tournaments like we had in Iran, then I think it gives people a little bit more inspiration.
Absolutely. Now, we've got to wrap up fairly soon, but I would think, obviously, the more coverage you can get. You had the documentary, The Power of Ruse, which came out, which, again, obviously would have raised your profile. I suppose it's in the next 6 months, maybe tapping into your two ambassadors, Marco Bresciano and Mark Schwarzer. If they can garner you a little bit more publicity, then those funds may come in.
Oh, look, you know, the Power of Ruse documentary was outstanding, and Tom Ferguson did a wonderful job, and I think, you know, that not only raised our profile in the community and helped raise the funding, but more importantly raised our profile within the football community. And there are more people working in football who now know who the Power of Ruse are and what we do. You know, Marco are just two of those. The more they're involved, the better. And each time we hear from them, we love it.
Well, Chris, it's always great to catch up, and congratulations to you, the team, and all the guys behind the scene, and especially all those people that have given up their time voluntarily to help you guys achieve what's a magnificent goal.
Appreciate that. Thanks for your time.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, very good, John, the way you had Gordon Banks there for Chris Barty, who was voted the goalkeeper of the tournament in the Asian Oceania Championships, which have seen the Power of Ruse qualify for their first ever World Cup. And it's just an amazing story, John, and those guys have worked so, so hard, and hopefully now they may get a little bit more money to be able to have the camps. As he said in that interview, you know, Iran are training full time together. No wonder they're so good and ranked so high, and of course won the silver medal at the Paralympics. But if Australia wants to compete with teams like Iran, they need to be able to spend more time together, practicing together. And they've got one sponsor on board, as you mentioned, Zest, and well done to them for coming on board. Hopefully a few others will come out of the woodwork so that they can get that time together.
When you consider the size of the soccer economy, football economy, it's a real pity that the sport can't do much more to support it, because we're not talking about a lot of money.
We're not
the scheme of the soccer economy.
Absolutely. And I mean, the interesting thing, and I didn't push Chris on this, and I don't know how many of our listeners will have noticed, that Marco Bresciano and Mark Schwarzer are ambassadors for the Power of Ruse. Now, I've got to be honest, I haven't seen them doing much ambassadorial work for them. Maybe they are, and I asked Chris that, and he didn't kind of touch on any of that. But you would think those two people, A, they've made some good money from the game.
Well, who chose them to be the ambassador?
I would presume the FFA did. But I would also think that they would have contacts in the corporate world that they could use their ambassadorial status to pull in people to make those possibilities or those opportunities a reality for the Power of Ruse.
Mm. And not just the Power of Ruse, but all the other para teams around the globe. It's not just, you know, the soccer is a, football is a global sport with a humongous global economy, and the sport should do more to help out.
No, totally agree.
Your turn. You've got to bring something up now.
Okay, now, well, I'm going to bring up the crowds at the Wacker for the cricket coming up. I know that when this goes to sort of air, the test match will have started. But I'm amazed that the decision was made to have the test match played at Optus Stadium. Now, it was interesting that the CEO of the Wacker, she said, Christina Matthews, that there was a deal done with Cricket Australia and the state government that any test that was predicted to draw at least 15,000 people to each of the first 4 days would be played at Optus Stadium. Now, that is strange, because if you remember, John, and we followed on this show the development of this stadium, and I've been against it from day one, I will still say that and admit that, but it was always said that it would only be the really big ticket events that would be held there when it came to cricket. And if you remember, they were saying the Ashes would definitely be held there, possibly South Africa, which is probably now the second biggest draw card in cricket when Australia plays. And then you've got obviously Sri Lanka, the West Indies, Bangladesh. They're not going to fill Optus Stadium. And I mean, India have proved now that they can't fill it.
Yeah.
And okay, it's a bad timing, because the way everyone feels about the Australian cricket team is slightly different at the moment. But I just think it was a bizarre decision to go and have it played at this new venue. Of course, if it's a cracking test match, then it will be a success. But to me, surely you want a full house and a good atmosphere over the stadium. But it seems to me that the state government now is built this thing and they're going, come hell or high water, all of you sports are going to use it. And we're desperate to fill it. We've got to recoup some of the money back as quickly as possible. And so you're going to play there.
Yeah, it was interesting seeing the crowds, considering the crowds in Adelaide last week as well. What we were getting about 25,000 a day, or roughly around that.
They had 23,802 on the first day in Adelaide, which was 32,000 fewer than the first day against England. So that just shows you the draw card that England are. I don't know. I just find it strange.
Yeah, and especially when you consider one of the big knocks on the Wacker ground was sitting in the sun in certain parts of the area all day. Well, the first thing they've done when they've moved cricket there is remove the shaded seating from sale. So you're going to have to sit in the sun there all day anyway. So, you know, that didn't turn out too good for the cricket follower, did it?
No, and also, if you notice, I mean, they've now made the announcement that all the public areas in the top tier at Optus Stadium have been closed for the test match, with about 1,500 tickets transferred to lower levels. So you go, why were you selling those tickets? Surely you'd sell all the...
Because that's a shaded area.
Yeah. Well, there
the
you
shaded
go.
Shaded areas at the top. That's why people wanted to sit up there, because they knew they'd be in shade. Now
they're not in shade.
Yeah, they're not in shade.
Are they going to turn up still? I'd want my money back. If I'd bought a ticket in the shade and was then put in the sun, I'd say, well, no. I bought that ticket. That's a contract between us.
Well, the whole point of moving... of not playing at the Wacker was for the facilities, and the sun was definitely an issue in all of this. Don't forget that people having to sit in the sun was a major issue in why the Wacker is moving out of the Wacker.
Yeah, I just find it astounding, and I mean, it worries me again. I mean, again, you've got great Manchester United coming over to play against Leeds United. I do wonder whether the people who put that game together realised just how much those two teams hate each other.
And I think they would have. I think they did it because they do.
Well, I hope the police are prepared. That's all I can say. And you can say you heard it here, because I don't think... there will be scuffles that night, guaranteed, is my bet on that. A few alcohol consumed and there will be a scuffle that night. But the thing is, the figures that I've been told that they have paid, the state government has paid to bring Manchester United here, you just go, wow, are we that desperate to fill that stadium?
They obviously are. I mean,
clearly.
Do I care? Not really. You want to have Manchester United and Leeds?
It's taxpayers' money though, John, at the end of the day.
There is that. I mean, it's a friendly. It's a pre-season warm-up game. I mean, there's nothing really on it. If you were talking about bringing Leeds and Manchester United to play a Premier League game here, then I might be a little bit interested.
Yeah, and of course there was talk about that a few years back, but it got knocked on the head by the English Premier League.
Soccer fans will love it. They'll go along. The Man United fans and the Leeds fans will love it. The Chelsea fans and the Liverpool fans will go, yeah, who cares? So that's where those things sort of sit. They'll still pack the stadium out. If they charge people to go along to training, that is a disgrace.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, because the Chelsea game, you know, they eventually filled the stadium. I say eventually because I heard a few days out ticket sales were pretty poor, and from my understanding there were a lot of tickets given away at the last minute.
Okay.
And discounted.
Yeah, that happens. And I would be terrifically peeved if I had got in early and bought a ticket and paid a premium price for it, only to find out that they were flogging them for cheaper, much cheaper later on.
Now, you're going to help me try and track down, and we're going to find it for the next podcast, because also the Bledisloe Cup, which is being held here next year in 2019, sold out really quickly, as you would expect, John. Now, when we had Ron Alexander on the show talking about the new stadium, and we discussed in that interview the situation with the drop-in seating and why they didn't go with the retractable seating, as was originally the public were informed was going to be the case, he did say in that interview, when the venue was sold out, they would put in the drop-in seating. Now, I, at the time of recording this podcast, have contacted Rugby Australia twice. I have yet to receive a response as to whether the drop-in seating will be inserted for that Bledisloe Test match, because we were told, remember, on this show, that if it was sold out, they would put the drop-in seating around the side of the pitch.
Well, you can't, because the seats go all the way to ground level. So if you put up anything in front of the... Gee, wasn't that a well-designed stadium, Ashley?
Yep, you know my thoughts on it, John, and I think in years to come we're going to find a lot more about the construction and the way it was all put together.
And who it was put together for.
See ya. We'll be back next week.